Hi, everyone. Welcome to a special year-end edition of the Reason Podcast Editors Roundtable edition. I said that twice now. I am Matt Welch, joined by my fellow libertarian elves, Catherine Mengu Ward, Peter Suderman, and Nick Gillespie. Ho, ho, ho!
Who are you calling at?
Merry Christmas.
You're not, to Julia Ioffe. Anyways, reminder...
That's 100% not how you say her name.
She's not on the podcast.
Reminder, please subscribe to us and write searing emotional reviews and confessions whenever possible at Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and so forth. So because of the holiday season and the days off next week, we had long been planning this unusually Friday-tastic edition of the Reason Podcast to do a bunch of news of the year roundup to make it less timely. And then, of course, because this is Planet 2018, Thursday became the mother of all news dumps. Stock market plunge.
The whole year's news happened on Thursday, so it's fine.
Government shutdown. Jim Mattis resigned. Letters. President Trump announced troop withdrawals, not just from Syria, but also from Afghanistan. So we're going to kind of blend, or at least we're going to incorporate some of these things in our own exercise that is forthcoming, which is each one of us is going to say what we think the best of 2018 and the worst of 2018 is, was, and shall ever be. Because we are in an industry where everyone's a gloomy Gus, let's start with our glasses half full. And I will take moderator's privilege and talk a little bit about why I'm so stoked about yesterday's announcement that it seems we're taking down half of our 14,000 troop presence home from Afghanistan. I will start this with a trivia question for the three of you. We'll see who gets the closest. At the time that the Taliban was successfully deposed by U.S. military force at the end of 2001, how many U.S. troops had died at that moment? Guesses? Anyone?
100.
3.
Peter?
Somewhere between that.
Peter's right. Peter's right, but Catherine
Price
wins
right,
because she was more committed. Seven. So.
Yeah. Can I just say Peter's right, but Catherine wins is kind of like it's generally
totally
true.
It's amazing.
Welcome to my life.
We could have said that, all right, here's the principle. The principle is if you knowingly harbor terrorists who you know are plotting against the United States and they commit an act of war on U.S. soil or against, U.S. Assemblages somewhere, you as regime no longer have a right to exist. We could have established that principle, and I would argue that's definitely an arguable principle to establish. And then declared victory and come home 2,400 U.S. deaths ago, and God knows how many Afghan deaths ago. Instead, it's the longest war, by some measures, the most unpopular war in American history. And part of the reason why I am happy about this is not necessarily the kind of well thought out way that it was executed. There's plenty of reporting that it was a surprise to a lot of people, that Trump acted in an erratic and chaotic way. Big surprise there. But it breaks for a moment the kind of nonstop intervention logic, which is to say, Howard Dean, the anti-war candidate, Elizabeth Nolan Brown had a great post this morning saying, by withdrawing our troops from Afghanistan, this is Howard Dean, you are condemning millions of women to the Stone Age. Over at Fox and Friends, Brian Kilmeade was doing the right-wing version of this to Sarah Huckabee Sanders this morning, saying, Trump just refounded ISIS. This type of argumentation, which has been bipartisan forever, is so difficult to stop. The reaction to it from the sort of Washington consensus of horror is, I think, indicative of this. It's hard to stop. And it took someone like Donald Trump, who campaigned on this and this isn't being brought up that much, but in August of 2017, he surged. It was a tiny surge, but he, as someone who had campaigned on kind of ending this or questioning it, he added 4,000 troops in August, much to my and our disappointment. So I'm glad to see this happening, and hopefully it's a signal of things to come. Nick, I wanted to go with you with this because you've been writing about both this and Syria. I have no illusions, and I don't think you do either, about this move making Afghanistan a better place. And that's not the argument for doing it. And I think it's important for people who are intervention skeptics to grapple with the reality, the worst case scenario being like what happened to Southeast Asia after we left Saigon in 1975 is still not a reason not to leave Saigon in 1975. Does it frustrate you, Mr. Gillespie, to see
Dr.
Gillespie, to see, let's say, not as much of acknowledgement that there is messy reality among those who are screaming their faces purple in reaction to this news?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's, you know, one of the things, American foreign policy has been in such a state of complete unreality for, you know, decades at this point. And the idea is that the status quo is somehow tenable, and any change to it, even we have to, you know, at some point we have to bring the troops home. And when you do and when you pull out, it is, Matt, like you, I can remember the, you know, the last airships or helicopters out of Vietnam. And it's messy. It's ugly. It is not a good thing. The question is, you know, when does the reset happen? And it has to. And it's bizarre and it's disturbing that it takes somebody like Donald Trump, who, you know, clearly doesn't know what he's doing in any kind of systematic way. But he made the right choice. And I think people who are all hung up over process or this or that are missing the larger picture, which is that we need a reset. And this hopefully provides it. I'm not as sanguine about, as you are, Matt, about the idea that this will actually change the kind of intervention logic. But here's hoping.
Yeah,
and we still have a lot of blood on our hands.
I don't think that it will, to be sure. I just am happy that it's evidence of somebody not succumbing to it. And that, to me, is welcome. Peter, I feel like you need to do, yeah, but Trump is chaotic and not doing it right, kind of thing right now. Or at least that, you know, the adult in the room has left with Jim Mattis walking out the door with a nasty gram letter.
I mean, sure, I think it's reasonable to criticize the way that Trump went about this, which is sort of refusing to take his advisor's advice at all, and doing it in a kind of ad hoc announcement on Twitter. I think a better way to do this would have been to sort of draw up a sort of more systematic process, like Trump, like Nick said. For Freudian slip there.
Ooh, doggies.
Like Nick said, he's not a systematic guy. On the other hand, what I actually think this really reveals is a kind of lack of a more dovish or just a less hawkish policy establishment, and like the kind of the reaction from official establishment Washington just totally agog that this is a crazy horrible day in Washington because the government might shut down during a period in which partially shut down during a period in which like almost nobody works anyway, and during and because Trump has made the decision to pull troops out of endless foreign wars thousands of troops out of Afghanistan, where we've been for a decade plus kind of doing God knows what. Nobody really understands even what the mission is there, that like there isn't a kind of expert community here that supports this stuff. And that's, I think it actually shows a real problem with kind of official Washington. And it's why even like President Obama, who was frustrated with a lot of our kind of our foreign interventions and, you know, sort of with the way that we have troops sort of all over the world and playing policemen to the world, wasn't able to pursue a drawdown, wasn't able to kind of get out of that because there's no sort of there's no kind of expert community. There's no sort of there's no sort of organization that has credibility, that has really sort of worked at like drawing up plans that make sense and processes and sort of and infiltrating some of these institutions, frankly, which is just what you have to do. It's a long game. We'll talk about that a little bit more when we get to my positive. But I think it really kind of reveals the like what is missing in the Beltway conversation is are people who talk about this stuff and don't and do so in a way that isn't sort of Trumpian and erratic. And, I like to think that reason provides some of that.
I just point out that Obama did surge in Afghanistan and more U.S. troops died there in his presidency than George W. Bush's. But I think your point about the lack of, kind of intervention skeptic establishment in Washington is totally spot on, and that lesson can't be learned enough. Catherine, we were talking about not leaving stuff on the green room floor here. Are we, as Jen the Libertarian, who's a great Twitter follow for people out there, alleged this morning, are we living through a Libertarian Christmas here with the withdrawal? Thomas Massey is making sure that we don't get voice votes cramming stupid crap through on the House floor. The possible government shutdown. We just legalized industrial. Mitch McConnell just legalized industrial hemp. Got criminal justice reform. Is Trump actually your libertarian boyfriend?
So I guess what I want to say first of all is no, obviously it's not the libertarian moment and everything will crumble shortly to dust. Just lay that out there as our baseline. However, I am
feeling... By the time we're done recording this podcast,
yes,
to be clear.
I am feeling unaccustomedly cheerful about politics today. And I think you got to seize the day. When it's here, you got to enjoy it. I went to the Free Beacon Christmas party last night. And it was amazing. I rolled in that door and everyone was like 14 beers deep looking at me over the rim of their glass like, I bet you're happy. And I was like, I am a little bit. Like, even if we do some fragment of some of the things that Trump has tried to do in the last 36 hours, even a little bit successfully, those will all be advances for things that I think are important.
And to be clear, the Free Beacon's misery was caused almost exclusively by the Troop Productions, right?
The Troop Productions and
Mattis, which is related.
It was
Mattis
was the freshest wound at the moment that this party began. But yes, it's broadly the I think not unreasonable read on the last couple of days, which is that the U.S. is even if we are not going to actually abandon either of these countries wholesale, because I suspect that we won't, right? Like, even when we say we are getting out of, for Christ's sake, we're still in Germany and Japan, just to be clear. So we don't get out of countries ever, but we will be entering a new phase in which the U.S. will not be actively engaged in two of these theaters where supporters of an interventionist foreign policy thought it was important for us to be engaged. I think we are having an accidental libertarian moment, which may be the best kind that we can get. A corollary to this, or sort of a flip side of this, which Dan Dresner wrote about in the Washington Post this week, is that support for free trade and also for immigration is way up. That particularly people on the left have rediscovered their zealous commitment to an open global order. I think it was, in 2012 or something like that, 66% of Americans think immigration is good. It's now 75%. Similar uptick on free trade. It's all predicated on the incredibly strong, basically irrational feelings people have about Trump and will therefore crumble when he, A, changes his mind, or B, is out of office. But I'll take it. Happy Christmas. It's a libertarian Christmas miracle.
Speaking of that, let's go to Peter's good news bit from 2018.
The passage of criminal justice reform in the House and the Senate. It's going to Trump's desk where I believe it's assumed he's going to sign this. The First Step Act. So the First Step Act is just a first step. It doesn't sort of solve all of the problems of mass incarceration in America, but it's a good first act. And, what I was hinting at before is that it is the product of a very, very long inside game in Washington, where I actually want to sort of, I think that, like, it's not bipartisan politics, although it kind of is. You have supporters on the right and left. It's intersectional politics.
Oh.
Where you have a whole bunch of advocacy groups, a whole bunch of ideological groups who all realized that they have kind of shared and overlapping interests based on their values. And
it's
so,
not bipartisan. It's transpartisan.
Sure. Right.
I mean, I like so that like, word. I'm trying to make that a thing.
But I mean, like, you go back and like the push for criminal justice reform started in many ways sort of with the evangelical community and the kind of Chuck Colson prison fellowship stuff that's been going on for decades. You had you had progressive liberal types who are just sort of have always opposed the conservative, you know, sort of hardcore lock 'em up, you know, tough on crime philosophy. And eventually it spread over to fiscal conservatives who realized that, look, locking people up for a very long time, a whole lot of people, costs a huge amount of money to taxpayers. And then, of course, you also had libertarians who, in addition to kind of buying some of the fiscal arguments and, you know, some of the sort of compassion arguments, also just sort of were like, this is a reduction in state power. And so there are all these kind of overlapping ideological interests that sort of hit each of these groups and their values in a different way. And this took years, if not decades, to put together. And even at the very last minute, even in early December, it was unclear whether Mitch McConnell was going to allow this to come to the floor. It's been unclear throughout the Trump presidency until relatively recently whether Trump himself was going to support it, even though he had some advisors on the inside of the White House, including Jared Kushner, of all people, who was pushing this. But it did come together, and it's a good thing. And I think that it kind of shows you, along with things like pot legalization and with gay marriage, sort of how some of these kind of long time and kind of like I said, intersectional, transpartisan, kind of more than bipartisan good ideas can happen. But you have to stick with them and you have to play the game and like work through the process. And eventually
part of that, too, I think, is the work, and it's hard to say, you know, who's in charge of the work, in fact that nobody is, and that's why it works well, of changing public opinion. I mean, the fact that Kamala Harris is out there talking about, like, would she actually come out for legalizing marijuana now, or at least decriminalizing to some degree? It's amazing. Someone who was a semi-authoritarian, law enforcement baddie in California now feels the pressure from underneath her feet to sing a much different tune on criminal justice. So it's something that Jacob Solomon's written about for a long time about public attitudes towards pot and gay marriage. At some point, they've just become, through us becoming more familiar with it or in our surroundings and realizing that the sky is not going to fall. It moves so far so fast that it's no longer tenable for most politicians who are not named Tom Cotton, speaking of free beacon parties, to oppose this stuff. The fact that this can happen with a law and order president who nominated Jeff Sessions is still a boggling and wonderful thing.
Yeah, you know, that's one of the things that's really kind of one of the benefits of Trump not being a systematic thinker is, you know, on the one hand, he almost tried single-handedly or did bring crime back as a presidential issue, which it hadn't been for, you know, a number of elections, and is now, on the one hand, he's constantly talking about crime going through the roof, and he's also signing.
Speaking of crime,
reform.
Are you committing one? Are they coming after you right now?
It's kind of a dicey situation, and I can't really say. But
don't incriminate yourself on this
clear.
Podcast,
Catherine. What is your good news?
Yeah.
So I, when we were talking about this podcast, I literally just wrote "good news TBD." Like I'll think of some later, and then struggled a little bit, and then I realized that, as always, the good news can be found when you back the heck up a little bit and look at the bigger picture. So I want to do my traditional, the good news is ongoing global poverty alleviation through the glories of free trade and specialization, as well as rockets.
Wait a second.
Let's go back to that one.
The rockets didn't alleviate the poverty. Okay. It's two different things on the list. The punctuation was unclear there. All right.
And the rockets aren't raining down on the newly
not the war
wealthy
kind,
people,
the
right?
space kind. So yeah, I just, you know, I feel like it's always important to visit these good news numbers. I went looking for the precise numbers on global poverty alleviation this year and found the World Poverty Clock, which I urge everyone to go see. It's just worldpoverty.io. And it is bizarre. It has little teeny. Did you guys ever play Load Runner? Do you remember that game?
Yeah.
Okay.
I played it on my my Gorilla computer, which was a black, yellow.
I only
Apple
played
phone.
Homestar. Sure, yeah, Runner. You did. Go on.
Okay. It's the same. There's a number of people who live in extreme poverty, and then there are little Load Runner figures escaping from poverty in real time. They're just running away from the number. It's beautiful. So, go check it out.
Are they part of the caravan, though?
No, well, we know what country the caravan is from. We see a little country flash underneath. Okay. So you see, and it's like, oh, right now, oh, India, Yemen. Uh-oh, somebody in India fell back into poverty. Oh, but another person in India got out. Bangladesh, it's like that. It's insane. So just overall, the current figure stands at 593 million people who are in poverty, which, you know, we should do better. We should keep working on this. But that number is 27 million people lower than it was 12 months ago. And keep in mind that that is out of a total of 7.5 billion people. So
is it also the case, and I don't know if the Poverty Clock does that, but a couple of months ago, there were a number of stories where a majority of the world's population is now classified as middle class. Which
every
is also
single
amazing,
one of these numbers is good and going in the right direction. Yeah. The rate of improvement has slightly decreased in the last 5 years, but it's still substantially better than at any other point in world history. So yay to that, first of all. And then also I went looking, and if you go to the Wikipedia page for 2018 in spaceflight, you can just scroll forever and ever and ever. And there's all these rocket launches, and they're from many, many countries. It's a global industry. And, you know, the Elon Musk Tesla Roadster Starman in space stunt was this year. I know it feels like it was about 30 years ago, but it was actually February of this year. You know, since then, there have been dozens of rocket launches. And, you know, I think the fact that these are happening largely, they're not entirely in the private sector, that they are happening globally, and that they bring us closer
the
to
the often
human.
Federally subsidized
sure.
private sector.
Absolutely. Totally. Lots of subsidies. It's a big, messy mess, but still good news all around for when we need to leave this planet because everything is bad.
Question for the group. Is there anybody who, like us, exults in the most incredible depovertization that's happened in this planet the last 30 years, more than a billion people lifted out of extreme poverty. Is there anybody in politics or even to some degree in sort of intellectual circles who celebrates this like we do, who isn't just hated by everyone? It feels like no one who said, you know, everyone hates Steven Pinker, or they're starting to hate Steven Pinker, at least on my timeline these days. The kind of politicians, Tony Blair, you know, if I'm not mistaken, kind of kicked off one of these UN rounds of poverty eradication, which is now like, you know, they'd set up their millennial goals for, I forget what year it was originally, let's say it was 2050, but now it's like, it might happen in a couple of years. It's crazy.
They blew through all. I mean, it's incredible. Yeah, I think the problem is that no individual person or even really any individual nation can take credit in an even remotely plausible way. And that's why no one talks about it. It's really, really hard for like even Tony Blair to say in a way that is convincing, like, I did this. And people want to talk about things they can take credit for or things that other people are to blame for. And this is neither. This is a large, complex, spontaneous process enabled by baseline conditions that are emergent from centuries.
You've got
of
to put that on
evolution.
A T-shirt.
I think yeah, it. I mean, but
that's
I think
the
it,
new
it's
a tariff T-shirt.
Matt, also to your question also, about the anger that's directed towards those folks is, I think, a product of the fact that if you take the Pinker message kind of at face value, that the world is slowly, somewhat erratically, somewhat sort of haltingly in some cases, but clearly getting better on a large variety of measures, what it tells you is that your like daily rage at whatever Trump or Macron or the EU or whoever is doing is kind of right at Putin, right? Is like it's like not that big a deal, and you should just calm down. And
that's
like,
true. When somebody's having a bad day, and you're like, overall, your life is pretty good. That's never a helpful thing to say,
right? And like people don't like that. They feel like they are not, their feelings are not being validated when that happens. And like politicians do well by validate, just like friends, actually, politicians and friends do well by validating the feelings of other people.
Put that on a t-shirt.
I think that it also is related to the idea that power, and you know, this is uncomfortable for large nations or powerful nations. Power is leaching out across the globe. America, and I, you know, this is part of the backdrop of Trump. Trump recognizes in a way that I think a lot of other American politicians don't even implicitly understand, that America is in relative decline to other nations, not in absolute terms, and our life standard of living keeps getting better, but we have relatively less power and less say over the world than we might have 30 or 40 years ago. That's true of any particular country. I think it's true of most corporations. It's certainly true of churches and things like that. And this, it's very destabilizing. And if your main source of identity is the nation or a collective, in a lot of ways, you know, this trend, which has been going on for a long time, and, you know, Pinker documents it in Enlightenment Now. But in America, I mean, since the 21st century, you know, things have changed. And it's, you know, it's very discomforting to people to, you know, not to be the center of attention. I mean, Trump himself, he recognizes it, and that's what his rage is, you know, the globalists and everything. That's what he's so angry about. But I think it's real.
Speaking of spectacular, Nick, what is your good news of 2018?
My good news, which kind of goes along with some of the stuff that Catherine was talking about, is I think that we reached kind of peak identity politics, not in the sense of like how it's going to play out in terms of actual legislative battles or fights over, you know, this or that kind of speech regulation. But in the past year, there have been a number of books, and they keep coming out, that kind of stress the idea that we have fragmented our understanding of the world to such a degree that we really have very few common purposes, and that there's a bunch of people, and this includes somebody obviously like Pinker, but also Francis Fukuyama, I think John Haidt and Greg Lukianoff in The Coddling of the American Mind, a guy named William Eggleston is the department chair of English or Comp Lit at Johns Hopkins, in a book called The Splintering of the American Mind. There's an intellectual pushback against the idea that, against identity politics taken to an extreme version. All of these people are sympathetic with the idea that there are groups that have been marginalized and shit on in ways that are, you know, absolutely horrid and need to be addressed and kind of acknowledged. But there also, you know, there is an interest in kind of an Enlightenment universalism, which had gone missing, I think, in intellectual circles for a number of years. That wasn't just
I have this
reactionary
sense
conservatism.
That is informed by my own bubbled existence. But with the arrival first of the mostly irritating intellectual dark web, but then kind of the spiraled out reactions and to that development of other kind of groups of people talking about stuff, that there is a broader team of people who are A, rejecting stupid cutesy labels for themselves that are self-aggrandizing, but B, feel like that the walls are closing in on what is a permissible debate and just ways to talk honestly about stuff, and are pushing out against it, and not necessarily only in a reactionary fashion. I think the first people who tend to identify such intellectual trends tend to be reactionary and therefore boring. They're just always complaining about the same group of people, the same group of forces. But I think there's a kind of a broader, more thoroughgoing and less ideologically anchored group of people who are like, hey, let's create a bigger space for talking about things and applying that kind of intellectual method to all sorts of things in a more sort of like journalistic way. But then again,
I think so. And ironically, it's partly due to something like intersectionality, which started as a concept in feminism, where certain types of oppression or identities that are linked to groups that have been oppressed end up having more of a claim on the stage or to, you know, to kind of go first. And you saw this in something like the Women's March, where women of color or women of sexual minorities, you know, were given more status on the stage than mere women, et cetera. And that, ironically, I think one of the outcomes of a serious intersectionality is that we are made up of a lot of overlapping distinct and incomplete groups. And as a result, in order to have better conversations and to have a better world, we need to recognize that and kind of allow more conversation rather than shutting things down. The book of the year for me in a lot of ways on this is really Tyler Cowen, the George Mason University economist, Stubborn Attachments, where he talks about, you know, we've kind of played out the command and control structures that came out of World War II, the kind of large dominating world global structures. And we need a restatement of a 19th century liberalism that is really predicated upon things like pluralism, a common sense morality, and a care for other people. And then the types of economic and cultural policies and mindsets that build long-term sustainable economic growth. I think, you know, this, you know, we were talking before, is like a libertarian Christmas dream or whatever for 15 minutes. But this is the opportunity, I think, in front of us and in front of places like Reason, because we actually have the policies.
Speaking
and
of
ideas
both policies
that
and sirens, Suderman, we have the ideas that make these policies work. And shifting now to bad news, your piece of bad news is about our ideas for how policies work are being widely ignored in a very crucial area. Please continue.
The deficit has, I'm just going to quote the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget, which does the best work on this. The deficit has never been this high when the economy was this strong. So typically, the justification, if there is one, and I'm not saying that I fully buy this, but if you want to justify a high deficit, it's that it's countercyclical, that it goes up when the economy is down, is sort of an effort to kind of fill some of the economic holes left sort of to by a struggling economy. And instead, what we have is an economy that's doing really quite well by a lot of measures, and an absolutely massive and rising budget deficit, rising, getting larger than it was projected to before Donald Trump became president. Even though it was projected to rise somewhat already, it is now rising even faster. And that's thanks largely to choices that President Trump and the Republican Congress have made. That includes the tax law that was passed at the end of 2017, as well as the spending deal that followed it just a few months later. Now, every single time I raise the tax law as a contributor to the deficit, somebody will respond, "Oh, you know what? They're just letting you keep more of your money. That's we shouldn't focus on that at all. It's not a big deal. It doesn't really have anything to do with the deficit." And of course, it's true that spending is by far the biggest factor. And if you want to reduce the deficit and the debt long term, you really have to focus and prioritize spending. On the other hand, when you reduce revenues and at the same time raise spending, what are you doing? You are increasing the gap between the amount of money that is coming in and the amount of money that is going out.
If you're gonna subtweet Paul Ryan, call him out by his name, Peter. Come on.
It's not just him.
You know, it's the Republican gospel.
Bob Corker,
I would say that, yeah, so when the tax bill passed in the Senate, Mitch McConnell, among others, was one of the most prominent Republicans to say, not just to say, "Well, look, we'll eventually get to cutting spending." That's not what the argument was. Their argument was that reducing taxes, that cutting tax rates would actually reduce the deficit. There is no evidence that this has happened. There's no evidence that that happened with the Bush tax cuts. That's not how it works. When you reduce government, when you reduce taxes, the government gets less revenue. And so unless it, in addition, cuts spending, it's going to raise the deficit. In fact, I think that this is a good thing, and that libertarians should be should not buy into the kind of supply side gospel that basically just says, well, if you cut taxes, then it you know, then the deficit's going to get smaller because it's going to actually end up raising more revenue through economic growth. That's the argument. If that were true, then cutting taxes would increase the size of government. Because what you'd be doing is making the government bigger by increasing revenues there. And so we should be glad that cutting taxes reduces revenue, but that needs to be paired with spending cuts. Otherwise, you are going to start digging yourself an even bigger fiscal hole than we are already in. And this includes entitlements. This includes sort of overall spending as well. This is not just about the annual deficit, which is nearing $1 trillion and probably going to be $1 trillion in the next year or two. It's, you know, I mean, we have a $21.6 trillion total debt. We've got $37 trillion in unfunded liabilities for Medicare alone. That's just one of the three big entitlement programs. This is a huge problem. And it's not just a huge problem that's getting worse sort of in kind of numerical terms. I think it's getting worse in political terms. It used to be that Republicans would at least kind of talk about reducing the federal debt and making that a priority. And under Trump, that has basically disappeared. There is now no one talking about entitlement reform, talking about significantly taking real action to reduce the debt and the deficits. And that kind of politics has just sort of fallen by the wayside because there's not really a public.
I would point out also, just quickly, just as a factual thing, the idea of increasing spending was actually part of the tax deal itself. There had been discussion. The House Freedom Caucus said we're not going to add one penny to the deficit. And their first thing that was passed at least paid some fealty to that. It got to the Senate. Bob Corker, among other people, said, I will not vote for this if it adds one penny to the deficit. James Lankford, with whom I have a internet bet about this, a Twitter bet about whether the overall deal will add to the deficit, and he's going to owe me a lot of money here. He said, I won't vote for this if it adds one penny. The final thing, as estimated, the deal that they made was like, actually, it's going to add a lot to the deficit. And then the House has to pass it or else it's not going to pass. And so all the people who said we're not going to vote for this unless it is revenue neutral just held their noses and voted for it. So it was baked into the system to have a bigger spending deal in order to pay for, in its own crappy logic, the tax cuts. So it was part of the deal. Go ahead, Nick.
I was going to say, since 2008, federal spending as a percentage of gross domestic product has been at or above 20%, which is extremely rare in peacetime. I mean, there's like a ratchet effect, essentially, at the end of the Bush years. And, you know, in his first 6 years, his first six budget years, when he had control of Congress, the Republicans spent a hell of a lot of money after having cut taxes successfully, and they increased a lot of problems. They only started to pull that in when Democrats actually, you know, when the Congress became divided. What are the ways to, like, try and, you know, unclick the ratchet down a couple of notches? Because, like, the U.S. government, basically, you know, for the past 50 years or so, has been lucky to collect about 17 or 18% of GDP. So if we're trying to reach some kind of balance, it's going to come from cutting spending. But what goes into that?
If that question is to me, I think that there's not really an obvious solution. The two things that might work in my mind are a kind of political payback, where basically one party decides that the best way to constrain the other party is through budget and deficit politics, and that they make that argument successfully to the public. I don't think that that's very sustainable, because as soon as that party then gets in power, we see this with Republicans. Under Obama, they complained incessantly about the deficit, and I think even correctly to some extent, but I also think it was a very cynical sort of complaint, because if you look at what Republicans have done, they've exacerbated the rising deficits that we were already scheduled to have. They've made the problem worse, both on the spending and on the revenues side. And so that's sort of a short-term solution. The long-term solution is that at this point, I now think we're going to have to reach some sort of crisis. We're going to have to get to some point where basically people feel the pain of a fiscal crisis or an entitlement crisis somehow or another, whether that's Social Security checks not going out or not going out at the full amount, whether that's a Medicare funding crisis, whether that's something like that. And it, believe me, I don't envy this happening, because there will be real and actual pain for ordinary Americans as a result of the bad choices that have been made now for decades by American politicians. But it is likely, I think, that that is what is going to that's going to be the trigger for
Catherine,
for
what's your bad news
at this point?
My bad news is the journalism industry's broad-based pivot to dust. And I think that, you know, it's sort of self-indulgent to say like, oh, it's bad that lots of publications closed when you happen to be a professional journalist. But I do think it's, you know, this is like the in memoriam section of the Oscars, where like they just like play a little sad music and then like remember
yeah,
those who have left us this year.
Back down. Go ahead.
Thank you. Wow. That was terrible.
My heart will go on.
My heart will go on. Yeah. So, I mean, just a reminder that and many of these actually like sort of but not quite entirely died. Some of them fully died. Mike shut down. Rare shut down. Vox terminated 5% of its workforce. BuzzFeed and Vice both announced that they substantially missed their revenue targets. Mashable shut down. It's just like a rookie shut down if you happen to be a lady person and care about that sort of thing. There's just a bunch of sites that have gone by the wayside. There's several reasons for it, perhaps not unrelatedly. A bunch of sites also unionized this year. We could talk about that. But, you know, the silver lining here is it's gangbusters for old school mainstream print newspapers. The New York Times and The Washington Post are doing better than they have in a long time. I think that is partially anti-Trump backlash, because everything is about Trump always, everywhere, forever. But also because they actually report actual news. They report it and then they give it to you, and they give it to you in a pretty fair, straightforward way most of the time. Not always, but mostly. So there may be a little bit of the market rewarding quality here, but there's an awful lot of there's a gale of creative destruction sweeping through our industry. And you know, that generally is to the good, but adjustments are always painful. Of course, also RIP, Weekly Standard.
The big newspapers are also doing well because they have developed a subscription model and basically made their readers supporters of their journalism. And it's not quite, you know, the sort of exact the same as a kind of nonprofit model, but it is. But there's a relationship. There's a similarity there.
And that hadn't been true for a long time, right? It used to be that the supporters of journalism were people who wanted to sell tractors.
That's right.
And that.
Or used cars, or
I broke down.
Yeah,
I don't think though that the good
Correct.
Luck for newspapers is particularly broad
That's
based.
True. Local papers also pivot to
dust. If you go even to the LA, but even the LA Times or Chicago Tribune, I mean Trunk.
They untrunked.
Really,
so,
it's not called
so the
that
LA Times now has a new zillionaire backer.
LA Times,
it's always Trunk.
The LA Times now has
Trunk.
A new zillionaire backer who is injecting new funds and
which
hopefully new life into that publication.
It's true though. Weeklies also,
or injecting life in the first place, because a lot of this, I think, was. You know, there was a hell of a lot of
Alt Weeklies also went down this year. You know, the decline of Backpage being part of it, but also the OC Weekly and others. Same deal, business model predicated on somebody other than the readers paying for the thing. And when they were like, hey, readers, will you pay for the thing? Everyone was like, nope. So,
Catherine, do you think that qualitatively, you know, that journalism is worse now than it was 5 years ago?
No.
As a, you know, or is that independent from, you know, publications?
I don't think that qualitatively journalism is worse. I do think it's relevant that public opinion says that people think journalists and journalistic outlets are less trustworthy. That number continues to decline alongside the numbers for various government entities. So, you know, I actually think the quality of journalism overall has not declined. I think it matters a lot that people believe it has. And I think part of the reason for that is the turmoil in the industry, or maybe the turmoil in the industry is partially caused by that. Even my bad news is good news, because I do actually think that this is a market attempting to clear and, you know, chaff attempting to be winnowed and other relevant metaphors. But the current response to it internal to the industry, which is more unionization, is not going to.
There was an interesting piece by Jack Schaefer and somebody else at Politico about a year ago that talked about the massive geographical overhaul of the news industry over the last 5 years, where basically local papers and TV stations to a smaller degree, but local regional news jobs have absolutely taken a gut punch. And now there's been with the rise, now it's more of a fall, but at the time a rise of internet startups has been disproportionately clustered in basically New York and Washington as well. And the numbers are staggering. It's interesting to go look at it. I think that that has led to identifiably lesser amounts of coverage of non-national and just sort of local and state news. And that's a bad thing. And I look forward to the market clearing in such a way where we get more of the reporting on that. Nick, what is your bad news?
The inevitable clampdown or lockdown on the tech sector, including a lot of social media and I think a lot of free speech online. Tim Cook of Apple a few weeks ago talked about how, and it just happened to be the week that Microsoft and Amazon eclipsed Apple briefly as the world's most highly capitalized company. But he was talking about how the free market clearly wasn't working and that regulation of the tech sector was inevitable. This follows a year where Facebook and Twitter and, you know, other Google have been called on the carpet in front of Congress, and there's a lot of saber rattling about antitrust regulation, about coming up with regulations to protect the privacy of user data and things like that. And all of the tech giants have essentially signaled openly that they're interested in helping to write the regulations that will bring some kind of clarity and stability to this sector. And it's, to me, that is the bad news story of the year, because I think we're seeing an inevitable, we're going to be living in a world that is going to be more regulated, and it won't actually help very much, but it will help to freeze the system kind of as
my,
it is
now. My bad news is a bit of a synthesis of Peter's and it's slightly of Nick's as well, because I think a lot of what's going to happen to social media is in the future and the regulation thereof, and it's going to be bad and stupid, and it's going to be done right as everyone's already evacuating those fields. But my bad news is that we haven't had bad news yet, which is to say that it's kind of
that sounds like good news.
Yeah, no, because
you think
if we have this much kind of rancor and dysfunction in this country, but also kind of globally, at a time where, you know, here we've had a 9-year economic expansion that's even until recently had been kind of accelerating. Now it's decelerating. We had until about 2 months ago a 9-year stock market boom. Now we're getting into a correction and soon bear territory. So if all this is happening, if all this really bad governance and terrible politics associated with it, completely irresponsible disregard for our long-term fiscal anythings, if all this is happening in a time when we haven't launched a new land war anytime recently, that the international conflicts that people are worried about are largely speculative and that they're not really happening. What happens when the shit hits the fan? Because it does. It always will. And it will, there will always be some like, oh my God, I can't believe this is happening, thing happening on the world stage, which we have not really seen in Trump's first 2 years in office. That's going to happen. And I think we're going to see at the very least a recession in the United States. A lot of the trade war stuff has yet to completely hit and affect people. And so I'm afraid that our irresponsibility during these good times and also political hysteria, which is at a constant and kind of debilitating and degrading pitch, is going to be all the much worse going forward. So that's my good news, bad news, bad news, good news.
So you're really excited for the House impeachment hearings?
Is there any way?
But that's
Yeah. Is there any way out of that, Matt?
I don't know how to. It's a similar answer to Suderman, like finally fulfilling the Naomi Klein idea of shock doctrine politics. At some point, things are going to be really crappy. The state and the local governments who have been as irresponsible the last 8 years as they were in the previous 8 years prior to the financial crisis and their subsequent bailout. Man, imagine the day that's coming soon when they ask Donald Trump for a bailout in Illinois and California and New York. That's not going to happen. So having just a smaller pie to divvy up is going to absolutely force people into the kind of desperate choices that, for instance, people like, you know, Jimmy Carter and Jerry Brown were making in the late 1970s. Like, everything seemed so hopelessly screwed forever that people were lunging for desperate measures, or desperate attempts. So that's about the only way that I can see out of this, particularly given that until I see evidence to the contrary, it seems to me that the kind of anti-Trump forces in the right and in the center, and to see even some degree to the left, are not spending enough time questioning their own contributions to how horribly things have been governed in this country on foreign policy in particular, but also on fiscal issues. If there's not an attachment of a rethink among those people as they eventually triumph or whatever, then it's going to be the harsh winds of reality. It's going to be the 75 cents on the dollar Social Security payouts, something along those lines, and interest rates. We don't have a politics right now that is centered around being sane on those issues. So.
Was there, you also recently released a video that was very good, titled something like When Democrats Believed in Deregulation. But, you know, and Brown, excuse me, and Jimmy Carter in particular are kind of the heroes of that piece. You know, at the time that they were, you know, we were having gas lines and gas rationing, we also did find a fair amount of deregulation. Is it possible that, I mean, I guess when you guys talk about a crisis leading to less government, the libertarian dogma is that crisis leads to fattens up Leviathan, and there is a ratchet effect. So, I mean, is there a way out of this that is not just like completely gloomy? Because we started off talking so happy. It was a Christmas miracle that Jim Mattis is going to have to go work for Mashable, which doesn't exist anymore.
That,
we're all good.
Maybe is a cause for optimism. Let's say, for instance, that this week, this month, this season ends with not the American public in complete revulsion and disgust saying, my God, Trump is wrong for withdrawing 2,000 troops in Syria that we didn't know were there. But instead, people are like, hey, good idea. I don't want my cousin dying in Afghanistan. I'm kind of with that. If there is a reward structure, if good things happen and not complete, abysmal apocalypse happen with the drawdown of American involvement in things abroad, maybe public opinion can be changed actually more marshaled than changed, because public opinion is way more skeptical about American involvement abroad than our elites have been for generations. Maybe there's a politics associated with drawing down the kind of imperial aspect of American foreign policy and military in a way that can lead to actual savings of dollars. I think it's in the future. I think it's speculative, but I want to hold on to some kind of positive thing. We don't have a whole lot of time here, especially me. So I want to pivot to our end of podcast. Best thing that you have consumed in the cultural sphere or wherever in 2018. And let's start with Peter Suderman.
Alfonso Cuarón's Roma, which is a movie that was released that was produced and released mostly by Netflix. There was a limited theatrical run It's not just the best movie of the year. I think it's one of the best movies of the decade. It is just a masterpiece. I've never seen anything quite like it. Cuarón has been kind of working his way through Hollywood for a decade plus now. He made Gravity. He made Children of Men. He's known for his kind of extremely long, elaborately constructed shots. But Roma really takes it to a new level, and it's personal in a way that those films weren't. It's a film about a caretaker in an upper middle class household in Mexico, set against the kind of political violence of the 1970s. It's all in black and white. And I want to just sort of note the movie for its excellence, but also the distribution system. And so Cuarón and others have said, well, the best way to see this movie is on the big screen. And really, it is a visual epic that does benefit from being seen in the, you know, the best possible presentation. On the other hand, what Netflix has done here is to make it accessible to just about anyone and everyone, not just in the United States, but worldwide. They now have 100 and something million subscribers, maybe more than that, maybe into the several hundred million worldwide. I don't have the exact numbers in front of me. But really quite inexpensively, along with a sort of package of a whole bunch of other stuff. And so it's not just that the best film, maybe the best film of the decade, is being produced by Netflix and is out this year and is a thing that it's that anybody can watch it for $8 or $10 a month at home without having to sort of fuss with going to the movie theater and paying for a babysitter and parking and whatever else it is, all of the added extras. And that to me is, yes, it's perhaps a slightly worse way of interacting with it. And I am, you know, sort of as people know me, I am obsessive about seeing and hearing things the right way, and yet making it available to more people, making it easier for more people to access this kind of truly, truly visionary pop culture is, I think, to the benefit of all.
Catherine, what is your end of year reco?
My end of year reco is New York Magazine, which is. It never is going to come up on a weekly recommendation because there's no kind of one specific thing or one, you know, angle that I want to push. But it is the magazine, other than Reason, that I read the most with the most delight and interest. The Intelligencer, which was just redesigned, is very good news and analysis. And The Cut is basically just so terrifyingly perfectly targeted to my demographic that it pleases me both because it's targeted at me and as an exercise in self-definition for a publication.
Their pop culture vertical, The Vulture, or Vulture, is really quite good too. They have maybe the best comic book journalist who is working in mainstream journalism today, a guy named Abraham Reisman, I believe is how you pronounce his name.
Also props to New York Magazine for still employing and publishing a bunch of people who now live on what is unfortunately the outer fringe of politically correct acceptability, including Jesse Singel, including Andrew Sullivan, including in about 5 minutes, Jonathan Chait. They have, surprisingly, to some extent, given their milieu, held the line on sometimes publishing stuff that's not entirely in line with the wokest best think out there. So,
is the union going to kill them?
They are not unionized, partially because they are the other part of this equation, which is that they are technically up for sale right now. There have been rumors of this for a long time.
But there is a unionization movement.
There is a unionization movement. It has not been successful so far. No. And I think at least in part because they're up for sale. And that's basically suicide. So props to New York Magazine. It's just a straight up good magazine that has a good combination of candy, which they literally label as candy articles, just kind of junky stuff, and real substantive journalism, including one of the year-end top pieces, a long essay by former Reasoner Carrie Howley about the Larry Nassar case.
Nick, what Jonathan Chait puppetry are you going to be recommending for your end of year?
He wrote a good piece about political correctness. Was that this year or was it last year? I can't even remember. But, you know, that's one of the benchmarks that were, I think, moving towards a better conversation. But no, this year, partly for reasons 50th, I went back and dug deep through the entire, you know, run, and which is available to subscribers. You can go online and you can, you know, basically go through the entire run of Reason from 1968 on. And that was my favorite thing to read this year. I've been delving back partly because we started in 68, a lot of late 60s stuff, including things like, you know, Norman Mailer novels and Reportage and, you know, Esquire and actually New York Magazine a little bit later, the early days of the new journalism. And it's kind of interesting, but Reason is, it was just a phenomenal read because it's, I think I described it to somebody as an off the charts utopianism and an off your meds apocalypticism, an interesting mix. And, I think that's what the world needs right now. And particularly the utopianism, because we are just, and I don't think I'm merely projecting, although I know, you know, it's partly, the shape that I'm in, but we are burnt out on, you know, the past 18 years. I mean, this has been a kind of wonderful century for the reasons Catherine pointed out. People are, you know, not just escaping poverty, they're joining the middle class. You know, the globe is getting better, but there's something seriously broken in North America and Western Europe. And I think part of it is the inability to get past where we've been for the past 50 or 60 years or 70 years, really, since World War II. And I think that utopianism that you can find in various parts of Reason up through the current,
I
know,
will
current issues
end
is
here,
really,
although that was a
read.
Fitting ending, but I have yet to go, so screw it all. Just by pointing out a couple things. One is that my 3-year-old daughter refers to me constantly as old grandpa dad, which is pretty great. One
that's how we refer to you in the
office.
Didn't
have to say that out loud. Say the quiet part quiet. And part of the reasons why I have felt for a while like an old grandpa dad is the way that the 21st century has befuddled me in the technology of listening to music. Music is in a very important part of my life. And I've got a record player and I got cassette players. I got an all-in-one thing. I got some MP3 files, I guess, but they're always terrible, and some iPod over there. Bunch of vinyl cassette. I got everything here, even got VCR here, but somehow it's all...
Do you listen to music, you know, on a VCR?
Actually, you've met Matt.
That was a great way you could get like a really long tape and you could just, you dub stuff
onto
a VHS
tape. Dude, I taped Live Aid. I taped Live Aid and watched that stuff over and over again.
Thank God. I was a baby when that was happening.
It's all on
Anyways,
YouTube now.
The result of this kind of scattered, I declared a defeat in the hands of technology because there just couldn't be any kind of marrying way of, I just didn't have a right way of listening to music. And this year I just started using, of all things, Spotify, where you can subscribe to the Reason podcast and should, Spotify as a way of just doing mixtapes of my own on my computer. Their library isn't as big as I would hope, but it's pretty damn big. And also I use the stupid Amazon Alexa, which a libertarian should never admit, but it's a great way to say, you know, shuffle songs by Serge Gainsbourg and getting all kinds of weird stuff on your computer. It has the use of technology in my old grandpa dad way has made this a much more satisfying music listening year that I've had in a decade. And for that, I'm grateful in a Christmas miracle style of way.
That was the most Matt thing that has ever happened. The last 3 minutes.
I know.
Yep. Oh, my God, Matt.
Matt, what was your favorite performance?
Was MTV VJ Mark Goodman with a poodle hair and dolphin shorts and like a tank top.
Sure.
He was watching Sting play. What song was he playing? Living Through Tears. What was that song like? Living to tears. Driven to tears.
Driven to tears.
Mark Goodman thought he was so clever. He's like, For this occasion, Sting changed the lyric to "too many cameras and not enough food." And that was so great because that's the original lyric of the song Driven to Tears, which is about global hunger. But Mark Goodman thought he was so clever in saying it. And I will never discount the enthusiasm in his voice about being so wrong in front of a billion people watching worldwide. So that's my Schadenfreude for the day. Thank you all for listening to the recent podcast, Editor's Roundtable Edition. Again, subscribe to us over to Apple Podcasts and elsewhere. We shall reassemble in this unit again on January 2nd. So we're going to take
2019.
That's a very strange thing. There'll be plenty of great recent podcast material between now and then, mind you, but we're going to see what kind of craziness is going to happen between now and January 2nd. It should be very interesting. So thanks.
We're all excited for the Democratic primary debates, right?
If we could make it through 5 p.m. today, I think we got a shot at this, at making it through the end of the year.
Happy New Year, everybody. Merry Christmas. Happy everything else you celebrate. And we love you.